We love our devices, phones, tablets, games. There's a gadget or gizmo to keep us busy at all times. But is that helpful?
Take 10 or 15 minutes a day to intentionally and literally do nothing.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear how our devices may be disrupting development and how we can respond. We'll also hear about a new online poll school and spend an academic minute with some interesting yays and nays. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. I suspect you and most of us have some sort of device plugged in and recharging right now. The average American over the age of 14 spends more than 10 hours a day engaging in some sort of screen. So how are our brains doing in this digital deluge? That's the question Doreen Dodgen-McGee tries to answer in her new book, Deviced: How Digital Devices Disrupt Development and How We Can Respond. Dr. Dodgen-McGee is a psychologist with 25 years' experience working with groups and individuals. I asked her why she took on our devices.
So the time that my own children were in middle school, which was 15 or more years ago, flip phones were just becoming a part of the very popular scene. And at the same time, my husband was working in high tech alongside the team that was developing the chip for the first smartphone. And so I was watching how these small devices that really could only make calls or send a few little, you know, words to each other were beginning to disrupt both the social setting of adolescents as well as the kind of solo or solitude time of those folks. And then I was hearing about what these were about to be able to do and how immersive they were about to be able to become. And it just began to hit me that the developmental trajectory that I have come to believe is a healthy one, where people have a lot of time for solitude and a lot of time for person-to-person embodied connection, was about to change radically. And then I thought, I'm going to start keeping an eye on this because I can't imagine this is all going to be good news. So I just began doing about 15 hours of research a week on both pop culture and the academic research trends. And over time, began to really see that, yes, there were some beautiful, amazing potentials that were being tapped into with technology, but that we were also seeing some really profound changes in our own, the way that we develop relationships with our own selves and then the way in which we interact with our embodied world. So from there, I started speaking about it a lot, and then I became more and more passionate and wanted to get the word out further than to just the places my body could get. So I decided to really dig deep into the research and write the book.
And you said you spoke to a lot of people and did a lot of research. Who did you talk to for this?
I spent a lot of time in the years where the book was really coming together on college campuses, talking with both university students and faculty. And then I also, at the same time, was spending a lot of time talking with parents across the developmental span, so parents of very young children all the way through kind of young adulthood, and pediatricians. And so this research comes from kind of the medical community, the academic community, and then just a lot of parents who are doing the work of trying to really help their children navigate the waters well. And then the young adults and adolescents were probably the largest group I spoke with. And that was what was so surprising to me, was that their experience is so universal, that they love the shiny potential of this beautiful digital domain that they're given access to. But at the same time, they feel overwhelmed and they feel the drain on their ability to focus.
You talk about the academic world. Could you imagine a modern school without screens now?
I can. I can imagine it, but it's hard to find it. One of the interesting realities that I have come to know about and that many people have uncovered in the media is that the largest number per capita of Waldorf schools that we have in our country, which is the only remaining school system that doesn't introduce technology until high school and then only very moderately. We have the largest number of those per capita in the Silicon Valley, which is where all of our tech, or a huge majority of our tech, is created. And I find it very interesting that the people who are creating both the hardware and these digital spaces that we love so much are desirous of having their children in schools that aren't engaging them at the same rate that most schools are. And I find that very telling, and it makes me very curious and makes me think a lot about, you know, how this stuff really is impacting us.
One of the things I got out of the book is that these devices give you more idle time and way more means to waste that idle time, too. How important is boredom in this story?
It is of utmost importance. When we lived in times, not that I think that previous eras were better than this one, but when we lived in times where, you know, we only had 3 channels on the television and they went off for a long portion of the night, or we just had to stand in line and only have access to our own selves rather than these supercomputers, it forced not only us to become behaviorally comfortable with boredom, but it also forced us to wire the regions of the brain that are responsible for helping us tolerate waiting, helping us tolerate the eventuality of sometimes having to do nothing. And so now that we don't ever really naturally have to be bored, we have both patterned our behavior in such a way that we aren't comfortable with it, so we avoid it. We actually seek out the stimulation of our devices. But we also have potentially really impacted the wiring of the brain so that we don't even have the natural proclivity to be able to kind of lean into it enough to actually try it out. And that concerns me. So that's why I am on a crusade to try to invite as many people as I can into what I think of as my boredom party, which is just to take 10 or 15 minutes a day to intentionally and literally do nothing, to just stare into space, to engage our creative mind and our imaginations, and to kind of find out what can happen when we encounter ourselves with no real time limits or no expectation that we have to be plugged in and available.
You spoke, too, about some college professors who will give some extra credit for taking technology fasts. Is that widespread?
It is, and I'm actually finding now that even some workplaces will encourage people to take what they'll call a digital detox. And I think those are wonderful experiences for people. I think they help people really uncover kind of the level of dependence that they have. However, I think it's time to move past us just thinking about scheduling, you know, a break once a year or doing a detox on one weekend, and instead start thinking about how we might moderate our use across time and how we might bump up the interest and the kind of subtle and appropriate risky parts of our embodied lives so that we have some reasons to set our technology down and we have some things to engage our bodies in when we do so. Because I think if we can begin integrating this into our everyday lives, a little bit of boredom and then a little bit of embodiedness, we'll have a much better chance of kind of mitigating the potential negative effects than when we just take small times of detox.
For a lot of people, is it more and more becoming the digital life is their real life?
Oh, this is such an interesting concept. Just a couple of weeks ago, I believe it was in the New York Times, but there was an article that really said that posited that we need to stop talking about screen time and start talking about the fact that we live in a screen gnome. And I think that is true, that we really, really, we are so impacted by the experiences we have in the digital domain. And we have historically, you know, thought about this as this kind of binary. There's our digital life and then there's our quote-unquote real life. And I really do believe that's an an impractical distinction anymore. And we must start talking with ourselves honestly about that, because when we are spending the amount of time that we are with screens, which the really great longitudinal research tells us is 10 and a half hours a day for the average American, it's beyond just screen time and embodied time. It really is that much of our entire lives are occurring in very intimate relationships with these small devices that we carry with us.
As you talk about this, as you say, crusade about this, are people seeing this as an attack on their real life?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think what I do notice is that the more I talk with a diverse range of people, the more shocking it is to me that conversations turn very quickly from the tech itself to the sense of absolute overwhelm. And that, I think that does maybe feel like an attack, that they feel overwhelmed. We all feel overwhelmed by the expectations that are created from others with our devices that will be plugged in and informed at all times, but then also from ourselves it's interesting to me that kind of the American obsession with productivity gets transferred even into our recreational use or entertainment use of our devices, that we feel like we need to tackle it all. We need to have consumed an entire season in order to be up on things. And I do think that that gets experienced as kind of an attack on the self.
Have you gotten, blowback from some quarters on this?
I have. And I appreciate people wanting me to think and wanting to make sure that I have all the information that I need. And I have been very informed by some of the blowback and changed some of my thinking. However, I also, one of the biggest things that I want to be an encourager of is that we all need to have non-shaming and complex conversations with each other about these things, about technology. And so when those attacks do come to me, I really try to listen well and see if I can't turn them from attacks or harsh negativity into a meaningful conversation.
For the love of God, stay away from Twitter.
Twitter has... I now have come to believe that that video gaming is a form of social media because it's where we connect, and so it fits in there as well, but that Twitter and video gaming communities are social media based around relational aggression, and they're not typically right now safe places to be.
Still to come, our conversation with Doreen Dodgen-McGee continues with a look at device addiction. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Doreen Dodgen-McGee, author of the new book, Deviced, How Digital Devices Disrupt Development and How We Can Respond. I asked if our devotion to our devices counts as an addiction.
That is such a great thing that I think we all need to be thinking about. In American diagnostic nomenclature, it is not formally recognized as an addiction. The World Health Organization has coded video gaming addiction as a diagnostic category. I know for sure that the research is out there that shows that we can create physiological and behavioral dependence upon devices, and that our bodies actually trigger the release of hormones and neurotransmitters in such a way that looks like other addictive kinds of physiological responses to things like food or gambling or drugs or alcohol. However, we have been slow to the table. Other countries do recognize internet use as an addiction. And I think whether or not we have a formal nomenclature, I think it's definitely a very appropriate thing to say that we see levels of dependence that are impacting people's ability to feel successful in their day-to-day life. And that's very important that we take honestly and very seriously.
All throughout the book, you have boxes that give ways for people to take action. And there are a lot of them, so I'm not going to get into every single one, but what are some of the ones that you think that all of us could do in our everyday lives?
I think one of them we've already talked about, which is welcoming opportunities for boredom. And a couple of ways that I encourage people to do that would be to, wherever you tend to keep your phone, either on your person or in your bag, to place a small journal and a pen or a flat stone that when you reach for your phone, there's something else there instead that you grab and you engage that is more embodied. You know, you maybe, you know, rub that stone in your fingers and kind of bring yourself to the moment, or you take that journal out and make a couple of notes or do a silly sketch or write a haiku. That's one that I love. Another one would be to learn a little bit about mindfulness meditation and maybe begin to practice mindfulness meditation starting at about 3 minutes a day and moving up to 10 minutes a day, because there's beautiful and well-constructed research that shows that when we can engage mindfulness meditation or something like it, like contemplative prayer or even rhythmic exercise that kind of gets you into that quote-unquote zone, 6 months of that, of just 10 minutes a day, can double the gray matter in the regions of the brain that are related to focus and self-regulation. It's a difficult practice to get 10 minutes in a day, and yet it's a relatively small ask given how much time we spend in other pursuits that will have a huge impact on our sense of ability to focus, our ability to come back to a regulated state, and I think also our ability to just function from what I call an internal locus of control, which is where we go inside of ourselves to feel, to kind of be able to soothe ourselves and feel confident in the world rather than to look only to the sources outside of ourselves for validation.
One of the things that I hooked on when I saw that is you suggest yoga Jedi training. I want Jedi training now.
Isn't it the best? You can do Jedi training. You just go get a lightsaber and then you stand like a Jedi, and on that, you know, as you draw the saber up into your maybe right or left side, you take that big deep inhale, and then as you pull it down to your chest, you take that exhale, and then over time you learn to do it like a real Jedi in your imagination. It's a great way for thinking about coming back into that regulated, embodied state.
Well, screens aren't going anywhere anytime soon. Are you hopeful that we will learn to control all this, or will they continue to control us?
I have to remain hopeful that we will find a way of dialing back a little bit to a more moderate place. I have to believe that, because that fuels my passion for getting the word out about this. And so my hope is that we will all listen to the message indicators of our bodies as strongly as we listen to the message indicators of our devices, and that we will do the hard work of bringing our use back to more of a moderate place, and at the same time enlivening and enriching our embodied lives so that we have some good reasons for putting our tech down some of the time.
Again, the name of Doreen Dodge and McGee's new book is Deviced: How Digital Devices Disrupt Development and How We Can Respond. Polls are everywhere, and as we get closer to the 2020 election, there will be more coming at us almost daily, sometimes hourly. Now, the Marist Poll in Poughkeepsie, New York, has created an online educational platform. The aim is to address some of the most misunderstood and misreported aspects of polling. The best of our knowledge is Allison Dunn reports.
The Marist Poll Academy looks to close the knowledge gap between pollsters and the public. Director of Innovation Jay DeDapper says the program is the first of its kind. He says much of the idea for the Academy sprung from poll experiences in the 2016 presidential election.
And, you know, 2016, a lot of the a lot of people thought that the polls missed it in 2016 after the election of Donald Trump. And the fact is that the polls, the national polls, the good quality national polls, like Marist and like several others, didn't miss it. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 2%, and that's what our final polls showed. But we don't elect presidents, you know, through the popular vote. We do it through the Electoral College. So I think what happened was that there was a lot of conversation about the polls missed it, and people were misled by the media and the way they reported the polls. And we've been answering those questions for a couple of years, and we recognize that whether it's reporters or the public or educators or people who work in politics, a lot of people deal with polling. They may not be doing the polling. They're not the survey scientists, but they deal with polling and pollsters, and they don't know as much as they should. And I say that having been a political reporter who dealt with our pollster, the Marist Poll, when I was at NBC. And now that I'm here and I've been doing this work, I understand how little I knew as a veteran political reporter, having reported on polls for decades.
He says the Marist Poll Academy has in mind three target audiences.
One is journalists, journalism students, journalism schools, journalism organizations. Another is people who work in politics. And the third is educators. And that means not just college educators, but high school educators. Because polling, I think, has a lot of relevance to, you know, obviously something like a civics class, but also in math. You know, teaching statistics is very dry, but if you can give real-world examples that people can relate to, polls are a really good way to do that. So this is kind of developed as we built out this curriculum, these courses, these online courses that are very visual and very much aimed at how we consume content now, which is on an iPad or a phone and in quick bites. We've developed it to look like that and to respond to that. And as we developed it, we recognized that the audience, which originally was pretty much the people we deal with, which is journalists and people in politics, is actually bigger than that. So the biggest audience, I mentioned three, the biggest audience is the public, because especially your listeners are very engaged, very involved, and they pay a lot of attention to politics and issues. So we do polling for NPR PBS and the PBS NewsHour, and we do issue polling about things like abortion, for instance. And we have developed with our partnership these very, very interesting ways of asking questions that get at the nuance, the shades of gray that are public opinion. It's not just yes or no. Those are the kinds of things that we want to talk about and want people to understand, and that's what we put into the Academy, is the kind of information that allows people to hear about a poll and know more about what that means than they did before they took the course.
Then how accessible is this course, and how time-consuming is it?
So it's free. It's online. It requires 30 seconds to register, which is, you know, name and email address. We're not capturing any other data than that. And then you're in. Each course, we have six courses right now, including what is a poll, some basics like that, questions, how to write questions, why questions and how they're written matter so much, election polls, and maybe the most important, what makes a good poll, kind of a checklist of what makes a good poll. These courses, each of them probably take 15, 20 minutes, maybe a half an hour if you really dig in. It just depends on how quickly you'd go through them. We're not giving a master's degree in survey research here. We're trying to provide information that is quick and accessible on any device, any place anybody is, where they can learn something that they can use almost immediately.
As for what's next?
Right now, we're creating case studies, and we are in a period of time when there's no better time to create case studies, because polling is so much in the news and is so much, you know, there's so much of it. And because of that, we have a lot of opportunities to create case studies that illuminate or, you know, help people understand the concepts that we teach in the Academy courses. These are going to be released, the first one's going to be fairly shortly. They'll be released every couple of weeks, and they're video. They're purely video, so there's no reading required. And they're video case studies that Lee, our director, Lee Marengoff, is doing the first one, and there'll be other people. And these case studies will really give people an understanding of news as it's happening now in relation to some of these concepts that we think are important that we've taught in the Academy.
Dadapper believes lessons learned from poll perception and interpretation in 2016 are already being applied ahead of 2020.
Our hope for 2020 is that, one, the polling products that got all mixed up in the public imagination, which was actual polls, polling aggregators like averages, and then those predictors. Oh, Hillary Clinton's got a 92% chance of winning the election. Those are not polls. And I think the public got, you know, justifiably confused about these different products. What we're hoping for in 2020, I think what we're already beginning to see in 2020, is a much clearer distinction between what's a poll, an accurate, scientifically valid poll, and what's another product. There will be aggregators. There will be some of these predictors out there, but I think the media is already doing a much better job of explaining the difference and kind of waving the red flags. It's like, don't look at that predictor and think that that means what you think it means, because it probably doesn't.
Reporting for the best of our knowledge, I'm Allison Dunn.
Yes and no are two pretty simple words with pretty clear meanings. So why do we have so many different ways of saying them? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How many ways can you say yes or no? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Stephen Howe, associate professor in the Department of English at the graduate school Fukuoka University, Japan, explores this question.
It might seem that yes and no are simple words, but there's the standard yes and no, informal yeah and nah, and regional aya and nay. We also have political aye and yay and triumphant yay. And we can say yep and nope. We can vocalize as uh-huh and uh-uh, and gesture by nodding and shaking our heads. So we have more than a dozen ways of communicating yes or no. This tri-modality, language, vocalization, and gesture, is quite exceptional, making yes and no an important area of research in understanding the origins of human communication. In the east of England, there are two additional words for yes and no, jeus and dow. Jeus and dow are also used in America. Colonists probably brought jeus and dow to New England in the 17th century. 400 years later, this distinctive feature of Eastern English still survives. Dow and jeus are not recorded in the Oxford English Dictionary. However, the Dictionary of American Regional English cites dow in Massachusetts, Vermont, Maine, and possibly New York State. There's also deo in Rhode Island and dow in New Hampshire. For jeus, jess is recorded in parts of New England and jass in upstate New York. Where do these emphatic words for yes and no come from? Jeus and dow most likely developed from dear yes and dear no. New Englanders migrated north to Canada and west to the Pacific. Cities founded by settlers from New England include Chicago, Seattle, and San Francisco. Is it possible that the jeus and dow of my forefathers traveled that far? That's the subject of my future research.
That was Stephen Howe of the Graduate School Fukuoka University, Japan. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.